I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God, I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal, I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton. I was on the, as I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Hey, it's Anna David. I'm the host and creator of this very podcast you are listening to. I'm also the New York Times bestselling author of 6 books, most of them about addiction and recovery. I speak at colleges about addiction. I speak on television about addiction. I speak about addiction. I created the website theafterpartygroup.com. Yeah. And that contains After Party Chat, which is addiction and recovery articles. They're really good. I can say that because I didn't write most of them. Most of them are written by other sober people who are brilliant. And these their articles get picked up all over the place, reposted on Salon and Huffington Post. So you know they're good. It is also made up of After Party Treatment, which lists almost all the treatment centers in California. And it's made up of this podcast, After Party Pod. By the way, I'm thinking of changing the title. I don't know. It's just a thought. If you have any thoughts about this, tell me. I'm trying to make this more about people who have experienced a major life change, not limit it to just people talking about getting sober, because I think everyone on this planet can relate to making a major life change and can be inspired by people doing that. So that's my thought. Love to hear yours. Today's guest is Ricky Rackman. You guys know Ricky Rackman. His real name, I didn't know that till this interview, is David Allen Ricky Rackman. If you really want to bug him, call him that. He changed his name when he was like 13. Anyway, he hosted Headbangers Ball on MTV from 1990 to 1995. He had this huge nightclub. He is like in LA for years, the Cat House, and he is the ultimate sort of bad boy rock and roller guy. And he also hosted Rock of Love. Oh yeah. He's friends with all those rocker guys. And the thing about him is that he's actually a total sweetheart. He won't admit it. I even tried to get him to admit it in this interview. And no. He is, though. I met him because we were both enrolled at UCLA getting our KDAC, which is, you know, certified to become a drug and alcohol counselor. And he would not admit this. He was so into the school. Oh my God, he loved being a student, sat in like the front row. And he and I are both actually kind of taking a break from it right now. But I plan to go back. We'll see if he does. Anyway, he's been sober over 2 decades and has a lot of interesting things to say about it. You know, he is a guy who does not shy away from the truth. And so he brings that here to you. I hope you like it. Okay. I hope you love it. Really I hope it is makes nice, you laugh, cry, tweet, yes, and Facebook. So with that, I give you Ricky Rackman. Shut up. Well, first of all, talk into the mic. And second of
I'm
all...
I'm sorry. This is all very new to me. I've never done radio before. Sorry.
Okay. You can't be... You can't... yes, I know. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to interview you, who have so much experience in this realm, yet was not talking into the mic.
Yet, do you understand that you started it, before you even introduced who I am, the first words that you said were, you can't. That was it. You started this whole thing off by saying, you can't.
Well, anyway, you were saying that you have substandard recording material that I
have. No, I have different. When I do my racing show and I go to the track and interview drivers, I just use some little thing that I interviewed.
Oh, really?
And then I just download it onto my thing. I buy recorders like $29.
Really?
And I used to have an expensive Tascam one, but that's not really exciting.
But like when I was just using a digital recorder, everybody complained. My listeners, you guys, they complained. How come your people didn't? They don't complain about the sound quality?
No, because they're too busy complaining about me to worry about the sound quality. They've got so many other things to complain about. Why would you nitpick the sound quality?
Yeah, so they don't have to hear you as well. God, that's an attribute. No.
I do enough things to piss them off.
Okay, I didn't need to introduce you because, first of all, your voice is so recognizable. And second of all, anybody who's listening to this already knows. They've downloaded. It's the Ricky Rackman episode, so of course they know.
Did you spell it right?
I you know what I like to do? I like to spell, as I told you, I think you spell it in a very girly way. If a girl goes by the name Ricky. She spells it R-I-K-I or R-I-C-K-I, Ricky Lake. Why are you just not even? See, for you, you know, the ultimate tough guy, I just think that's funny.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because I had the worst, my real name is the worst first name in the world. So I had to get rid of this first name because every time I heard my first name, it made me ill.
Edwin?
So do you know what my real name is?
What?
David.
Oh, you're so awful.
Honest. It's true.
David Rackman. Well,
no,
it gets worse. Name.
David Andrew Rackman. How many people would go to David Rackman's world famous cat house? Nobody. But Ricky Rackman's world famous cat house, they would go to.
So you, total like nom de plume, as they say in writing. You just picked that name out of thin air.
Yeah, when I was 13, not even planning on being on TV or radio or anything.
And you just said, I hate my name.
Yeah, pretty much.
Was there a Ricky that you admired?
No.
No, you just
No,
liked.
And Ricky was a really cool name when you were like 12.
Yeah.
But then when you get older, you know, you want to go to Rick, but I didn't go to Rick because I chose going to Ricky. And then that's one problem, which is now to the point of it just being kind of weird.
Yeah.
But
gets less
now, I don't think of the name.
Yeah.
And my name goes so well with my last name.
It does.
And when I hear people talk about it, they don't talk... Not to bore you with this, but this is just a real quick story. You can probably edit this out.
No, I edit.
But I remember one time. Now's the time to start. I remember when I was had been on MTV for probably a couple months, and I was walking through the Denver airport. I even remember where it happened, and somebody said, "There's Ricky Rackman," and it was the first time that somebody had said Ricky Rackman,
right.
And it wasn't like because you know me. It was like my name became a product.
Yeah,
my name
became.
Synonymous with at that time Headbangers Ball or with anything.
Right.
So when somebody says Ricky Rackman, it's not like it's just like, oh, hey, what's happening? It's like
right. That
it was weird.
You're right.
It was really weird because all of a sudden I was a product and I was a product that I didn't necessarily enjoy. So.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, what's weirder about it is it's one thing to hear somebody say your name for the first time when you realize that you don't know them, but that you had made up the name, that you had made.
No, I didn't really make it
you
up
did,
because I, but
did.
I did when I was like a kid. It's not because I wanted to get into. So by that time, you know, this has already been, you know, 15, 20 years that I've been going by the name of Ricky.
Right, right, right.
So.
Can I tell you a funny story about
getting
recognized? Me. When I was first on that show that nobody I knew actually watched called Attack of the Show, and it was on this network called G4. And
I watched it.
You did?
Uh-huh.
Obsessively?
I'm kind of a nerd.
Yeah, I know. That's your conglomeration of so many things. You're so much more interesting than I would have thought. And I mean that as a compliment.
There is no possible way that is a compliment, no matter how you say it. Go ahead, tell your G4 story.
Okay, my G4 story is just that nobody I knew watched this television show, but I would get tons of email about it. And so one day I was sitting at the 101 Cafe, you know, on Franklin, mm-hmm. and I had my computer and I was going to work. And it was the new Apple, you know, it was kind of laptops or sort of, whatever. I was sitting there and this guy comes up and he goes, "Oh my God, G4? And I thought it was the first time I was being recognized. And so I give him this huge smile. I'm like,
Oh, no.
I go, "Yes. Oh, my God. Yes." And he sits down. I realize he's a total lunatic. And he goes, "That's a G4 computer. That's an Apple G4 computer, right?"
Oh, no.
And here I've been so friendly and nice. And I realize that he's talking about my computer and that he's insane. And I'm like,
No.
Anyway, excuse me.
That's funny.
But you get recognized a lot.
Yeah, it's usually like, "Are you Ricky Rackman?" I'm like, "Yeah." They're like, "You suck." I'm like,
they don't do that.
Not really that much anymore.
No, I think you're very well liked.
No. You know what it is? It's the people that don't like me are very vocal about it.
Yes,
so,
yes,
so if there's, you know, 100 people that know me and 80 of them like me, those 20 are going to let everybody know that
right.
they don't like me, which
right.
is okay because I just do exactly what I do and I do everything. And, I get the things that I get criticized for sometimes – I find preposterous. I get criticized because, you know, I like different types of music because I submerge myself into different scenes. Not that I'm just trying to fit into anywhere.
Right.
This is just what I do, you know. I mean, there are people that criticize me for going into NASCAR as a profession. The
right.
reason I went into NASCAR as a profession is because I love NASCAR.
Right, right,
the
right.
reason that I was doing rock and roll because I love rock and roll. If I happen to listen to country, so be it.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
People were mad. I mean, now it's okay that there's rockers with short hair. But when I cut my hair in 1992...
It was betrayal.
People were just furious, furious. Now, like, everybody's got short hair. It doesn't matter.
Right.
But people were furious.
People need a life. I mean, that's the dumbest thing, to get mad about you cutting your hair or mad that you are listening to country. I mean, please. But here's the thing about you. This is what I would say, is that I think that you kind of have this, like, don't give a fuck attitude. Like, you kind of, like, you're actually a super sweet guy in my experience. And I would not know that from your persona. I don't even know why you're giving me that dirty look. But like, okay, for instance, okay, so we met, I'm going to get you to walk through your whole history, but we met when I was newly sober and we were working at that retarded website, remember, a billion years ago, and I really, you know, really tried to schmooze with you and you were not interested.
I really have no idea what you're talking about right now.
No, you do.
No, I don't remember.
I'm not going to, oh my God, we just talked about this recently. You worked at a website.
I worked at a website? I'm not.
You worked at a website. You were on a contract. They were doing video.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The ones that ripped me off.
Yes.
The ones that made me bitter at the internet.
Yes.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
Yes. And like, we thought they were all such like scammer, whatever. They're not that different. They're a lot better than a lot of the people I've worked with since, sadly. But yeah. But so, and you and Downtown Julie Brown.
Yes.
And I was like, hey, you were not interested. You didn't care that I was like, so then when we became friends later, I was surprised at what a sweet guy I think you are, actually.
The first part, I know that I'm kind of standoffish and people don't know me, but I think you're wrong. I'm really not. I'm kind of an asshole.
I know, but
I'm not. You know what it is? You want to know the honest truth? What it is I'm honest. And the last thing, and this I don't mind. This is something that I've learned a lot about myself in the past year, I think. And I really don't like making anybody sad. That's what I've learned in relation. My relationships world is so screwed up, and I hate making people feel sad. And if I make somebody feel sad, it makes me feel twice as bad.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if that has anything to do with what you just said.
Well, yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think that you're a lot more compassionate than...
I think I am.
Than you seem at first glance, you know? That's a compliment. Don't look at me like that. But okay, so we met because we really became friends because we were in UCLA together.
Right.
We went back to school.
I was all excited. I like bought a UCLA sweatshirt, UCLA t-shirt. I go to UCLA, and Anna just loved to tell me, no, you go to UCLA extensions. I'm like, look, I've never been to college. Okay, let me say I'm a Bruin.
It was really cute. And like, the thing is, the experience. So we were both there because we thought we would get this KDAC, degree. Not even the thing. Like, we were basically preparing to take this incredibly difficult test so that we could become drug counselors.
Yeah, because you have your following, I have my following, and we had some grandiose idea that, you know, you're sober, I'm sober, we both have a following. Wouldn't it be splendid if we could help people? Wow, what a weird idea, but...
Look at us now. What? Are we not sitting here on a Saturday afternoon trying to help people? In a way, we are. I think.
I don't know.
Well, so... But so anyway, and so we were all super into it. We had our classmates. We had like the little derelicts that sat in the front row that you kind of took under your wing.
Yeah, I had them all at my house for Thanksgiving one year.
You had them over for Thanksgiving. And then, you know, when we would study together. No, you didn't study. I had a little study group and I really liked it. And then when I started putting my company, first of all, you dropped out. So we took like three or four classes,
right.
And they were legitimately hard classes. Right. And then you were gone, and they're like, "Yeah, Ricky Ragman, he dropped out." And I'm like, "You know, that's so lame. How could he drop out?" And then I am now a fellow dropout, but just because I'm trying to put this company together, and I don't have time to like.
Well, this is why I believed that. You know, I don't talk about my sobriety hardly at all.
I know.
I did on a show I did. I opened the show and just spent time talking about myself. It's not because I keep it a secret. It's not because it's something that I'm embarrassed about. I'll talk about it anytime I want, you know, and anytime if anybody wants to ask me about it, I'll talk to them about it.
Right.
Or ask me any questions about it. But I really felt that being on TV and radio and living what I believe to be a pretty decadent rock and roll lifestyle and being as sober, you know, people don't know that through the entire time on Headbangers Ball, I was sober. I've been sober 25 years. And I thought, you know, maybe I have something to offer. It would be really good if I could. And it really wasn't even a money-making thing. But so I started interning at one of those expensive rehab places. And I was cleaning up dog shit every day, washing dishes and picking up cigarette butts for rich clientele. And they were nice people and everything, but I'm like... I had a problem with a sober living place taking care of people that they don't even pick up their own cigarette butts. It's like, look, I don't care who, how famous you are, how much you're paying to get in there.
Right.
Learn some responsibility and pick up your own shit.
Right.
I was picking it up, and you know, and it just, it was like, you know, when you're doing one of those things where it's like hours and hours of waiting and nothing's happening, days just go by and you can't wait to get out there. And I'm like, well, hold on a second. I do a radio show that takes me about 2 hours to record, and I make in a month what some of these people make in 8 months.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, why am I working so hard trying to do this when there's so, you know, I mean, there might be other ways that I can help in the long run. And who knows, maybe I might go to school. I just thought it'd be kind of cool to get a certificate.
Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, I totally get it. And I think that I didn't realize it was going to be as challenging as it was, and that I was as out of touch with going to school as I was. But I liked being in school with you, and I liked our other friends.
Yeah, that was the best part about it, was like kind of the camaraderie, seeing the same people. And it was good because, I mean, you're younger than I am, but there were some people in the class that were a lot younger than us.
Oh, they were like 18
years. And when they were talking about certain drugs that we weren't privy to, it was like, yeah, I'll tell you what it does, because everybody in the class had done all the different drugs. You know, I didn't know about cat. I didn't know about all this other stuff. So like, well, this is what happens. And so everybody's just sharing all their experiences doing these certain drugs, which is much better than you're going to get out of a book. So
I can find out about that. Like, that basically there were those two guys, you know, Grant and what was his name? I can't remember, but it didn't matter what the teacher brought up. She'd be like, well, you can, you can start injecting alcohol. And they're like, did it. You can start, you know, you can take snail shit and snort it. Did it. Yeah. Like, it just didn't matter.
Right.
That was fascinating.
Yeah, it was great.
But yeah, but then there was a lot of science, and that was hard. But basically I read one blog entry that you wrote about being an addict. It's on your website. You talk about yourself in the third person.
You talked
about how you think you were given your first joint at 4. Is that true?
That's what I believe. How did that happen? From what I understand, the legend goes, my father worked in the music business, and what I had heard, that we were driving in Joshua Tree when I was a kid, and somebody thought it'd be really funny to get, you know, little Ricky, or at that time David, and they thought it'd be funny to get me stoned. So someone gave me pot at 4. That's what I'd been told by my parents. I don't think that's the type of story that my parents would make up. That's
but
probably
your
the
parents
thing that
are these nice people.
My mother is. My mother is. My mother and my stepfather are great.
Okay.
And my father's great too. It's just he was doing, you know, he did some drugs and was.
And do you have a relationship with him still?
Starting to build one again.
Were there other things that were like that irresponsible that happened in terms of his parenting?
When I was a kid, it was one of those things that, you know, I thought he was the coolest.
Yeah.
Because he had, I mean, he was, you know, his girlfriend was Karen Black, you know, the actress. So when we grew up, that was like our stepmom almost.
Right.
So, and he was driving different sports cars and a Corvette or a Bentley, and he was working with all the biggest rock bands. So, you know, he was my hero. But I also remember plenty of times, you know, sitting at the porch waiting for him to pick us up, and he never came to pick us up.
Right.
There were certain things like, hey, we're going to go here, and we had to go to things with him. And, you know, it just, it wasn't, and as I got older, the relationship got real, real, real bad. So we spent many, many, many years not talking at all.
Right. And you have a brother or sister?
I have a sister.
So you have a little sister? Or she's older?
She's 2 years younger, but everybody thinks she's older.
My brother's older and people think he's younger. It's not getting that way. But and you were very angry at him.
I don't really want to talk about that part.
Okay.
As far as anything else, I'm always an open book.
Yeah,
and I talk very, very openly about everything. But as far as that, just because this is something that's kind of
new
on the mend now.
Yeah.
And I'd hate to say so much stuff that it would just hurt everything that we're kind of working on now.
But
which is weird, because I've never ever said in any type of interview, chat, log, anything, I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
So I'll talk about anything else, but I don't want to talk about that.
No, good boundary. Good boundary. But you don't remember that joint, you know.
No, I don't remember that.
So when do you,
I remember cocaine at 13 though.
Okay. So how did that happen?
We're driving in a truck. Me and my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And, I had done my term paper on cocaine. Now, granted, this was at a time when not everybody was, the kids weren't doing drugs.
Right.
You know, this was at a time when cocaine was very, very new and very fresh. And I did my report on cocaine and said stuff like, you know, instead of buying a gram of cocaine, you could buy a Sony Betamax, or you could buy, you know, and I could list all these things you could buy instead of buying cocaine. I did all this stuff about cocaine, which is just bizarre. It's like, what kind of kid does his paper?
How did you know how much it costs? How did you find that out?
Researched, looked in magazines. I mean, I never thought about buying cocaine or buying drugs, you know?
Right.
I didn't even have a... All I cared about was skateboarding.
But why were you interested? Why did you pick that as a topic?
I have no idea. So I had done that as my paper, and then I remember my father said, have you ever tried cocaine? And I was like, no. And he's like, want to? Like, okay.
But, really? Yeah. In a car? You were driving in a truck?
Yeah, he was driving. And I tried it. And I was like, well, is it going to mess up my skateboarding? Because I was a dumb kid, you know?
Right.
Because me and my friends, we would do everything to look for, you know, because my dad, he smoked weed, you know? Right. And we'd always look for his weed. And I think like, oh, look, I think these are mushrooms, you know? And it was like sand we were eating. We don't even know what it was, but we thought, you know, we'd always look for drugs.
Right. So you did it. And did you immediately like it?
No, I don't remember. I didn't. I don't know if I probably didn't do it for years and years and years and years and years after that. I mean, right. It wasn't until... later that it started becoming, you know, as I was working in clubs and stuff like that, then the coke started getting all over the place. And then being an economical guy, I found out, I decided meth was so much better than cocaine.
Much better.
Because it's like, you know what, I mean, why spend, just keep on spending when you can just get it, you're just screwed up for a couple of days.
Yeah.
Do you want to know, I love this story. I have a real bad memory, but I love this story. When Slash told me that I was a bad influence on Axl because of my meth use, that's when I was like, I must be abused because I was doing so much meth.
So how did that happen? Okay, so you grew up here.
Mm-hmm.
So you're skateboarding around.
I mean, I grew up, when I'm saying right here, I mean, we're on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
And right now we're 6 miles from my elementary school, junior high school, high school.
Wow. Okay, where'd you
and
go?
And where I live, in the valley.
Okay.
And I live right now, I live up Laurel Canyon, so yeah. I live real close to here right now.
So you...
Oh my God, I'm going to have to put money in the meter.
Oh, shite.
Look, it's okay, I've got... Hold on, let me see how much time.
Yeah, I usually try to get people to set a timer. Oh.
Oh, I've got time.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got time.
Yeah,
sorry.
I shouldn't let listeners know that you had to put your glasses on to see your watch.
I'm wearing my glasses all the time now. I'm wearing my glasses all the time.
Really? You look very smart in them.
That's the illusion, see? I know. That's why I should really, I look really smart. And then anybody
really
talks
do.
To me. And then they talk to me and they're like, oh, okay. Just leaking glasses. You can't polish a turd.
So, okay, but so you grew up with this kid, and how do you go from this skateboard-loving kid to a meth addict who's a bad influence?
I was always smoking weed. Whenever mm-hmm. there was weed around, I loved to smoke weed mm-hmm. because that's what was around, and I would always drink. When I could find booze, I would drink.
Mm-hmm.
I would drink nonstop. And when I, you know, we'd find, you know, there was always the liquor store with the lady that she always does some minors to there so we can go buy our apricot brandy.
Right. Disgusting.
You know, when we're just
Stephanie
little kids.
Too.
Yeah. And so I was always drinking. But I remember, like, even when I was 18 or stuff, I would drink so much Jack Daniels. And I would always, like, save the empty bottle, which is weird. I'd always save an empty bottle. And this is when I lived with my mom. And my mom is, like, nice, normal. My mom and stepdad, they were, you know, teachers and principals. And I would always, like, put a Jack Daniels bottle up on the wall, like, in my room. And pretty soon, it's like, by the time I'm 21 or 20, it's just, like, a sea of Jack Daniels bottles.
What did your nice mother say?
I don't know why she never questioned me on that. I mean, I was a punker, so they were already confused with me anyway. But I don't know why they didn't say, like, why do you have all these Jack Daniels bottles?
Right,
you know?
Right.
I never knew that, why they didn't bring that up. Because they brought up everything else. But so I was just drinking forever. I've always been a big drinker.
And so you graduated from high
school. I'm good at drinking.
What do you mean? What does that mean?
I know how to drink.
Yeah. How do you drink? You mean because you could drink Jack Daniels and drink a lot of it?
Yeah, I get really drunk and act stupid, but it was one thing that's like, it's dark out, I'll drink.
Would you, like, were you an angry drunk or did you get
everything.
Fights?
I wonder if I got more fights sober.
Yeah, you've done your share of fighting and sobriety.
It's not any stupid. I got in fights.
Right.
I got in fights, been to jail, made a lot of mistakes. Drunk driving.
Right. So you got DUIs and you went to jail for that.
Uh-huh.
And then, but okay, so you graduate from high school, you don't go to college, you stay here, and you're living at home with your nice mother. And did you, when did you start working for MTV? Like, how did this all happen?
No, just to be real quick, there was a clothing store on Ventura Boulevard called The Factory.
Okay.
And I said, I want to be your DJ, because I've loved music since I was a little kid.
Right.
And they had DJs in their stores, so I started being their DJ. Yeah. Then I became a club DJ, and I was a very, very, very successful club DJ. Okay. I was playing all the big clubs. And then I came through cocaine through that way. I used to sell mixtapes with a gram of cocaine in it. So I was selling coke, and I was doing coke, and I just would, and I was out every night playing clubs.
How did
playing
you start
clubs.
Selling coke? How did that happen?
Because people would always go to the DJ booth and go, got any coke?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The DJ often was the guy who had it.
Right.
Yeah. So you had some like big deal drug dealer that would give it to you? Or?
There was another person that would give me coke, but it was that typical don't get high on your own supply.
Yeah, whatever.
I would do cocaine.
Yeah.
And I would sell it, and I was doing it, and it was a freaking mess.
Just so you were a mess. Was not quote unquote working for you? Like,
God,
did you think you were having fun?
See, when I was, I mean, whether it's problems that I've had with depression, I know that there were a lot of times that I was real, real depressed about it.
Right.
And my drinking, there were times that I had a lot of fun with drinking, but usually it was just, the thing is, if an alcoholic can control the way they are when they're drunk and say, I'm only going to have those fun days when I drink.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to, well, then you know what? I keep on drinking. But the truth is, it's not the fun days. The fun days get fewer and fewer. And then there's not fun days,
Yeah. I mean, in your last couple years, did you have any fun days?
God, no.
Yeah.
No. It got really, it was one of those, if I didn't stop, I'd be dead.
Right.
It was one of those things.
So, okay. So you're DJ, you're doing coke, you're
selling
coke.
I'm DJing. And then I was working at a bunch of clubs. And then I decided to open up my own club, which was the Cat House, which was a rock and roll club, which became the biggest rock and roll club in the world. Every band wanted to play my club because it was the coolest rock club.
And that was on Sunset?
It was on Highland. It was on La Cienega, where the Beverly Center is, and then I moved it to Highland. And when I say every band, I mean, Alice in Chains, Stone Temple Pilots, Black Crowes, Megadeth, Guns N' Roses, Alice Cooper. Everybody wanted to play my club, and it got me famous because I was taking this club on tour,
right.
And then Axel called up MTV and said, and to set up my audition for me, he's like, do you want me to go to New York with you? And I'm like, yeah. So me and Axel went to New York and I auditioned with him on that. But I actually had started to get sober before that.
Okay, wait, first of all, how did you open a club? How did you even know how to do that? Did you have investors? What did
Hell
you do?
No.
You just went.
I was a club DJ, and I was a successful club DJ, and I went to this Osco's Disco that was like torn down. It was the disco they used in the movie Thank God It's Fridays, and it probably hadn't been used. It was like, that was like a disco era Donna Summer movie.
I love saying this. I think I'm too young.
Uh-huh.
Okay, go on.
I've seen movies that were in the 40s, okay?
Let me have it, okay?
Go ahead. Because I don't think, I was probably four when it came out, but I still saw movies.
Okay.
the one thing that I've always been blessed with is a skill of not necessarily bullshitting, but being able to sell.
Yeah.
But anything I ever try to sell somebody is an idea that I believe in. Like I don't do anything unless I think this is going to be something great.
Right.
And so I convince this guy, hey, let me DJ this club and we're going to play rock and roll here, and it's only going to be a rock and roll dance club. And there was no rock dance clubs.
What year was this?
1986.
Mm-hmm.
And it started so slow, so slow. I mean, a great story was that the first person that showed up was Lita Ford. And so I kept on buying drinks for Lita Ford, buying drinks. Come on, stay in my club. And she ended up puking, right? So there was a funny thing that at the ending of the first night, everybody's like, it didn't do so well. You must be pretty bummed. I'm like, Lita Ford puked in my club. And they're like, maybe people aren't ready for a rock club. Maybe this isn't the time. And I'm like, dude, Lita Ford puked in my club. Like, I thought that was it,
Wait, I have a job question. She was a model?
Lita Ford.
Sorry.
Lita Ford was she was a model.
Okay.
No, she's not. She was a singer. She was in the Runaways.
Oh, yeah.
And she also had a solo career where she had that song, Kiss Me Deadly. Kiss me once. Oh, never mind.
I guess I'm too young. I'm kidding.
No, it's not.
No,
you're too
I'm
young.
Just too young.
Really? Have you heard of Elvis Presley? Oh, never. I guess I'm too young.
So.
Not everybody is REM or whatever stupid bands you listen to.
Alanis Morissette. I like all music, okay?
Obviously not.
I guess not. I like a lot of music. Anyway, I listen to podcasts. What I was trying to say was, so you said you opened up this club and then you were already trying to get sober, though?
The club stayed open. The thing is, you know, as anybody that's in recovery knows, just because we're sober doesn't mean we're not
insane,
screwed up. You know, most addicts have an addictive personality, which also I think means that most addicts can be are very, very creative. That there's some things that we have that, you know, that maybe we'll persevere, or maybe we'll try a little bit harder because we know that we used to try really hard to get our drugs and we used to try really hard to get our alcohol. So, you know, I took all of my issues that I had with addiction and kind of turned it into something to push me harder and harder with the clubs. And so I got sober and I became obsessed with the club and worked my ass off to make it as big as it became.
How are we doing on your thing? We should have put a timer on.
Huh?
In 5 minutes we'll stop.
Oh, I'm good.
What do you mean when you got sober? What did you do? How did you get sober?
I worked as hard. Well, first of all, there was a point in 1988 where all of a sudden everybody was getting, all the rockers were getting sober.
Okay.
Like it was cool because Steven Tyler and then Motley Crue and then everybody else. And I remember that Nikki Sixx and Motley Crue was a band back then. And Motley Crue, Nikki called me and he's like, dude, I'm in some rehab in Arizona. Will you go fly up and get me and then we'll drive back? I'm like, yeah. So I did that and they were going in and out of sobriety and Nikki was. And I went to a meeting with him. And
in the 80s.
Yeah, this is 88. And I went to a meeting and kind of paid attention to it. And then I got a drug counselor because I was kind of screwed up.
Right.
And,
so like a therapist.
Yeah.
Sort of. Okay.
Yeah. And I stayed sober for 6 months and then I went out again.
Right.
And then I decided to come get sober again. And I never went to rehab.
Yeah.
I did go to AA meetings. Mm-hmm. Did I work the program exactly as it's supposed to be? No.
Did you work it at all?
A little bit. Not much.
Uh-huh.
Not much. But I became very obsessed and with sobriety. I mean, there's people that we all know that are addicted to AA. That they have to go six...
I don't buy that, by the way. Look. Okay, don't look. God, you look like you are.
Okay, not addicted,
me.
But... Yeah. They have to go like... I'll say addicted. That these people, that this is what they live for. There's people that preach on a soapbox to tell you exactly how to stay sober. And God love them because you know what? 99.9% of the people are not going to get sober the way I did.
Right. That's
you know?
True.
I mean, that's one true. Thing. I don't want anybody to take from this, well, Ricky did it without working the steps.
Right,
that means
right.
You can't. I don't want anybody to think that because I did work the steps and I did get a counselor and I did. But what happened was as I got sober, and this should not also be an indication, I was getting more and more work and I was getting all these gifts.
Right.
And then I convinced myself
that it was because you were sober.
That it was because I was sober.
Yeah.
And then I lost everything. Then I'd been sober probably 10, 12 years and I lost everything.
What
I went
do you mean
bankrupt.
By you lost everything?
I went bankrupt. I had no job. I lived in an apartment with no power, no anything. This wasn't that long ago. This was like 12 years ago.
And this was after I had bankrupt.
And I stayed sober with, I was doing talk radio.
You were doing talk radio.
And I stayed sober through all that and reinvented myself. And now I believe that the day that I touch any drugs or alcohol that I'm not going to be given any more chances.
Right.
You know? I know that I like breezed over something so major in like 2 seconds.
I know. Don't think we're not going back. But the thing is, so it's almost like it's like you have a paranoid idea that your success is directly connected to your sobriety.
That's not a paranoid idea.
That.
That's a fact.
Right. So, but when you lost everything, how did you keep the faith then?
Because I believed that I wouldn't get another chance if I got loaded.
Right. So did you want to drink and you just sort of were resisting?
Or? I always want to drink.
You always want to drink?
I think about it.
Really?
Not to the point of I always, like, there's a desire, like I'm white knuckling it, because I don't. I mean, do I ever think about it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I rode my motorcycle from New York to Los Angeles, and I met a friend in North Carolina, and we stopped at all these tourist attractions. And one of the attractions we stopped at was in Lynchburg, Tennessee, where they make Jack Daniels. And I went on the Jack Daniels tour and went the whole tour to see how they make Jack Daniels. And was there a point in it that I said, man, it would be really cool to sip some Jack Daniels in Lynchburg, Tennessee? Was there a time that happened? Yeah. There was a time that I thought that'd be kind of cool. But you know what? I've been sober that long, right. There's not a chance in hell I'm going to give that up.
Right.
I'm riding my motorcycle across country right now. How right. lucky am I?
Right.
How lucky am I? So I'm not going to blow it. There was a time, I'm a big race fan, and there was a guy that had this guy that used to run this track in Bristol, Tennessee, and he said, this is a glass of moonshine. He goes, this jar from moonshine? He goes, Dale Earnhardt drank from that jar. And I thought, man, that would be cool to sip that same moonshine.
Who cares?
Okay, well, I do. It would be like, I don't know, whoever
don't
you look up to. But I don't. I mean,
right.
the thing is, if, you know, there's nothing that I, if there's anything that, if all this blabber that I say, the only thing that I can tell people about recovery is the one thing that is the most true, that nothing truer has ever been said is when they said the one day at a time.
Yeah.
Because nothing has been truer, because the second that I hear any freaking celebrity go on TV saying that they're staying sober this time, I'm going to be sober forever.
Right.
I'm like, you're so getting fucked up again.
Right.
You know,
right.
you so are. I don't, the reason I don't talk about my sobriety, it's my thing. If people want to know about it, and if I can say something to help people, then I will.
Right.
But I'm not, but hey, I've been sober 25 and a half years.
Right.
Am I going to be sober 26 years? I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
But I don't look at it like that. I
right.
look at it as I am today. Not going to drink. I'm not going to leave here and get a drink.
Right.
Every day I will live one day at a time. Because if you start, you know, I used to obsess of how am I going to stay sober this New Year's Eve? New Year's
right.
Eve is going to be so hard to stay. How do you stay sober on New Year's Eve?
Right.
You know, and then
like
New Year's Eve would pass.
First, right.
And then New Year's Eve would pass. And then it's like, oh, but how am I going to stay sober on my birthday? And you get through those things.
Yeah.
And that's why if you do it one day at a time and you say, I'm just not going to get junk right now. I'm just not going to do it. I mean, it's the hardest thing to do that to succeed, you don't do anything.
I know, right?
You know? I mean, if you want to be this great athlete, you have to work out and you have right. to do this stuff. To be sober, you just have to not do something.
I know.
Just
I
go
know.
Around your life and not do something and you'll succeed. That's the number one rule.
Right.
Don't do it. I mean, the number one rule of any type of recovery, I don't care what anybody says, the number one rule is just don't fucking touch it.
Right, right.
You know?
And it's also for, I think, alcoholics who struggle with issues in sobriety, it's like when you really want something, like, don't go and try and control it and try and make it happen. You know, it's that weird, it's that fine line between suit up and show up, you know, but don't try to control the outcome because that's, you know, don't do it. Like, it's like the whole, there's like an expression, when in doubt, do nothing. You know? But you
should I go run down and put money in the meter real quick?
Maybe. I mean, I was sort of, yeah, let's do. During our fun little sojourn, our little break downstairs. What?
We're not talking about drugs anymore?
No, we are. We're going to go. It's all connected.
How long are your podcasts?
3.5 hours.
Are they really?
No, I'm kidding. Calm down.
Because I don't know how you're going to edit this into something.
Oh, that's funny that you think I edit it. A podcast, Ricky Rackman, is great because it shows the humanity of the people because it's this unedited, it's like listening
to a conversation. But if it's an hour, then people are just like, oh,
no,
okay,
people will listen
screw the humanity, please.
I've listened to podcasts that are 2 hours.
Huh?
I've listened to
like podcasts. Like who? Who would you listen to a podcast
There's
for 2 hours?
There's a podcast that...
I know you're going to say somebody I've never heard of.
It's definitely someone you've never heard of. There's a comedian named Pete Holmes who has a podcast called You Made It Weird, and sometimes it goes to 2 hours, and I listen to every minute.
And it's just him talking.
And to a guest. To interviewing somebody.
Okay.
So drugs, I mean, I don't want to get too far off that because, I mean, this is also what I am thinking I want this podcast to be. Yes, I love that it's about recovery and I love that I talk to a sober addict, but I sort of want to make it also about to anybody who has overcome some major challenge or had some major shift. And so that's why I was kind of...
Oh my God, I've had... It's you can't call it a midlife crisis because I've been having them my whole life. and this is the one thing. When you don't have kids, you really don't have a concept of time. Because if you have kids, you see your child and you see your child grow and you see your child turn to 10 years old and to turn to 16. And you see that little baby and that's happened in 16 years.
Right.
Well, if you never have kids...
Right.
You don't see that. So the next thing you know, you're 45 and you thought you were still 25.
I know.
And it never, ever changes. And you're just like, And but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's just, you know, it's getting to be a point now that it's kind of weird because I really am that typical guy that never grew up. I mean, I never did. My house is, you know, still got fun stuff in it, and I ride my motorcycle every single day, not across town, across countries. You know, I've been in Mexico, Canada. That's all I love to do. And I listen to my music too loud, and I drive a fast car, and I do all that stuff. But just because that's what I've always done, not like I'm trying to recapture my youth because I never got rid of my youth, but I'm really on that verge right now of just about touching creepy old guy stage, that when you do that stuff, like, you know, it's like, okay, Ricky, you can't wear, you know, shorts and a hoodie anymore because now you look like creepy old guy.
Is that a certain age, or how do
I don't know. I don't know, because I see 40-year-old people that look old, and I see 50-year-old people that don't look
young.
Old. I don't know.
We
also live in a society that
worships youth.
That what?
Worships youth.
Yes and no. Yes, it does, but I think that girls, guys, young people are thinking certain older people were cool. You know, when they think like certain musicians or rock stars or actors are cool, you know, as we were kids, we would never think that somebody in their 40s or even 50s were cool.
I don't know. I mean, I think Los Angeles is obviously, you know, I mean, it's not exactly an original idea to say that people worship youth here. But it's funny because I was complaining about how when people call me ma'am in a store, how I want to punch them.
I say yes, ma'am.
Okay.
In the South, I do.
Well, and so somebody tweeted back at me, you know, look, I was raised to say that. Why in Los Angeles is that a bad thing? And I wrote back, because we're not allowed to age here. And so
also because LA, they're not allowed to be cordial either. I did an experiment. Oh, my God. I'm a runner, okay? I run all the time. Right. So I did an experiment. This is honest truth.
Right.
And I ran Fryman, which is, it's kind of like in the border between the Valley and Hollywood.
Yeah.
And so I run Fryman, and I run this all the time, and I see these people, and I wanted to see how many people will look at me and say hi. Only one type of person would look at me and say hi.
Dog person.
No, because it's all dog people.
Okay.
The only people that ever look at me and say hello are black women.
Shut up. Really?
Black women are nice.
Look. LA is a friendly place. Have you ever lived in New York City? Where basically you are treated like a lunatic if you smile at a stranger.
Customer service is gone. People don't give a crap about how they treat people. And people are generally not very nice.
I think they are nice.
Have you ever spent any time in the South?
No, but I'd like to.
Okay, that's why. That's where people are nice.
Well, look, I mean, I do think a little bit it is the energy one puts out. If I walk around and I am smiling, people are going to be nice to me.
Maybe just because I always look grumpy.
Waiting for someone to be nice, then maybe in growling as I run Fryman Canyon, maybe they're not going to reach out and hug me.
Maybe it's me.
But going back to this idea of the transition, so you feel like there have been a lot of things you've overcome.
Oh, yeah. I've always had problems. With work, I work too hard. I'm always worried about, am I going to keep this job? Is this going to happen?
Right.
Where am I going to live? This and that. But my relationships have always been a complete, utter mess.
Okay, so you've been married twice.
Yes, but only really once.
But for 10 years, for a significant amount of time.
Almost 10 years, about 9 years, yeah.
And why, I mean, that's some success, right?
Definitely,
without a doubt. So then why are you saying that your relationships have always been a mess?
Because they are.
Why?
Because I'm not good at it.
Why?
And now I've become not necessarily worse, but just more realistic. You know, people always say I'm a pessimist. I'm a realist.
Right.
You know, just because I say something is negative doesn't mean that I'm just being a pessimist. I'm just saying stuff that's accurate.
How
the way
you see
it is.
It. Right. But a lot of things are perception.
Right. Oh, you have to think positive. Okay, thinking positive isn't going to do jack, okay?
That's not true.
It is true. Okay.
The cops, they found out you're here?
Huh? Yeah.
I mean, really? But, you know, I feel like you'll roll your eyes at this, but it's like when I start getting into a grateful state of mind, and I start getting grateful for what I have, more things come to me. And if I can stay in that, it continues that process. And if I start to get embittered and I start to worry about where is mine and I start to think that everyone else's life is better than mine, then that's what comes to me.
Well, or but like work begets work. If you're working, yeah. you keep on getting more work. And when you're happy, like for instance, I was on a meeting, on a conference call yesterday with something that's going to really good that's happening.
Right.
And I'm talking and I'm pacing back and forth and then my mind starts thinking about more things. You know, if somebody gives me this little cupcake and talks about, okay, here's your cupcake, you know, in no time, I'm creating these big, huge cakes out of it, cake factories and marketing and, you know, everything that I'm thinking of doing because I always try to blow everything up really, really huge.
Right.
So in that way, you know.
But is that alcoholism? I mean, is that sort of like
one cupcake isn't
enough? I need a big cake factory?
Well, that's been my whole life. No cars fast enough.
Right.
No motorcycles cool enough. You know, I can't just buy that one comic book. I need to get the whole collection.
Right. I think that's alcoholism.
I think addicts like to collect stuff. I think. I'm like one of those dorky collectible stuff. You know, like, oh, I researched something. Oh, I'm really into this today. And I'm going to go on eBay and try to find everything about it, you know?
Right. I don't do that. I mean, but I will know. Back when you could rent movies and you didn't just watch them at home, I would go and I would rent 3 movies, even though I was only going to stay awake for half of a movie. You know, right. I really, like, I had to be sort of extreme and have too much out of this fear of not having enough or whatever it was.
I don't think renting 3 movies has anything to do with that. I think you're just really fishing right now.
I'm not. I would find that weird. I mean, and I'm super alcoholic about my work and all of that stuff. But so in terms of recovery now, you don't do anything for it now, right? You don't go to meetings.
I do a lot of stuff for it. I don't drink.
Yeah.
And I don't do drugs.
Okay.
And I talk to people when people want to talk about it.
Does that happen a lot?
Once in a while.
Uh-huh.
I talk to people in recovery. Occasionally, I'll go to a meeting.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My sister took a cake, and I went to a meeting for that.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's opportunities for me, I would love to go. I'd love to go speak at schools. I'd love to go speak at prisons. I'd love to go speak at do all that stuff. I like talking about it, but I go to meetings occasionally.
Right.
But it just kind of, you know, if you go to a meeting, it's not only just for the to help cure the need to drink, it's you get other stuff out of it.
I mean 100%.
The principles of it, you know, whatever you say, whether you don't believe in God or whatever your principles are that you have a hard time coping with that 12-step program, the program is helpful for having a good life. There's a lot of things in it that are just people should do in general, whether they're alcoholics or addicts. You know, there's some good stuff.
And so why don't you do it more then?
I don't know.
Your life is good enough? You don't need it any better?
No. But I do stuff.
Yeah.
I take care of stuff.
Well, I mean, I do feel like we skipped a little bit, like, the dark meth days. I kind of wanted some of that, but you want to just give us, like, a little bite of that? So you started doing meth. You were snorting it?
Uh-huh. I never did needles.
Oh, wow.
Never did needles. It would have happened.
Right.
Meth is not good.
Yeah.
Meth is, it's like, you know, if I look back at alcohol, I mean, I am an alcoholic. Without a doubt, I'm an alcoholic. I cannot drink.
Right.
But I can think of a time that I had fun on booze.
Right.
But I can't think of a time that I had fun on meth.
Even the first time you did it?
Oh, God, no. I mean, maybe, but I mean, the thing is, for me, if you're a workaholic and you're using that type of drug, it's real bad because you use it to keep you going until you're wired and then you're this. And then it gets to be nighttime and you should probably go to sleep, but you really can't sleep. And then it's morning again and you're like, got to keep on doing it to get it. And I went 5 days with no sleep and I was seeing dogs in the street that weren't there and I was seeing others. And that was snapping.
Taking computers apart and trying to put them back together?
No.
You didn't do, like, weird projects?
No. But there were cops in the trees, and I did sit into my tiny, tiny closet to do meth off of 8x10 one time.
Ugh, God.
Yeah, so all that stuff. It's bad. It's just so gross, you know? I mean, the one thing, and now it's so tough because now, you know, we're brought up in a society where, you know, the biggest problem isn't the meth, and it's not the coke, it's the pills that the doctors give you. And if a doctor, I mean, this is the honest to God truth. I had surgery on my foot. I ran the LA Marathon. I had to have surgery on my foot. I went to a doctor, and I said, look, please don't give me any narcotics because I'm in recovery.
Right.
And he gave me Oxycontin. This is the honest to God truth.
Right,
honest to God truth.
He gave me Oxycontin.
I might have taken one day after the surgery, and then I didn't take it after.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I know. They, you know, but they're trying to crack down. You know, I did the other thing, which is when I hurt my, I have sciatica, I have this bulging disc in my back. And I told the doctor, don't give me anything. You know, I went through this whole thing. He's like, great, I won't. And then the pain got so bad that finally I you know, talked about it with my sponsor. I was just like, okay, I'm going to do this. And, he gave me something called tramadol, which is a non-narcotic, pain reliever. And it didn't do anything. And then he gave me codeine. It didn't do anything. And I asked for something more. And he was like, no. Like, he basically thought I was, you know, an addict trying to relapse. So he wouldn't, you know, I'm like, Jesus Christ, my, now you're going to screw me for being honest with you? But yeah. Yeah, no, pills are a problem, and they're in medicine cabinets, and, you know, people are doing those drugs, like drugs I've never even done, and then they can't get the drugs, so then they're, you know, hooked on opiates, and they're doing heroin. You know, it's really, it is really, really dangerous, and I think that whatever people can do to sort of tell people that, you know, you don't have to live like that, that there is a life after that, and that, like you said, you know, all these gifts came to you.
Without a doubt, I'd be dead. Without a doubt. There is nothing, there is not one single part of my life that would be better if I still drank or did drugs.
Yeah.
I would be dead. And if I wasn't dead, I don't know what I'd be doing, but there's no way. I mean, you know, and I still think one day maybe I'm going to be 90 sitting on a porch drinking Jack Daniels, yelling at the, get off my yard, kids.
Oh my God, I, you know, I always think about that. I can picture doing that without the Jack Daniels. Uh-huh.
But I know when I get 90, if I live to be even that long, but I know that I won't. You know,
right.
but I'd still have that grandiose idea of,
right,
of being an orny old drunk, you know, but it's it doesn't work for me. I mean, all I know is that nothing, I mean, when you think about it, if you really think about it, think of your body and you think, okay, well, I can't be creative unless I have that. What are you talking about? Just think about your body. Everything that you do when you're high, you are very capable of doing sober. I can tell you, I have done some really crazy, stupid things sober. I've done a lot of things that I really regret sober. That'd be really easy to say, hey, I was fucked up when I did it. I can't, that excuse.
Right.
But I can't use that excuse because I still do stupid stuff sober.
Right,
you know?
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's a good note to end on. Your fan club is here, it looks like. Who are these people? Can't thank you enough for doing this.
Oh.
For coming on my little...
How long was it?
It was really long. I don't know. I think you talked for like an hour and a half. No,
see?
An hour. It was good. It was good. I'm stuck. Hey, you liked that, right? I liked it. I liked it. Yeah. Go tell your friends. Go give us a review on Amazon if you feel like it. Even if you don't feel like it, how long would it take, you know? 3 seconds. I mean, probably by the time I finish this sentence, you might have been able to do it. And it is really good because it helps spread the message about what we're doing here. And it helps other people find us. And it helps me be able to continue to produce these podcasts and do that. So if you like this show, please help us continue by doing that. We're not even asking for money. Yeah. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Even if you don't do that, I thank you for listening to this, and I'll see you next time.